I fear not only for my own safety, but for the safety of the community and my family. Again, I couldn't save my sister.
This is a true crime and real-time roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We dive into crime stories covered by Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. The Memorial Day holiday kicked off the unofficial start of summer in the U.S. last weekend. And with warming temperatures, some communities have reported that crime is heating up. According to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, more crimes do tend to happen in the summer. In this episode, we'll check in with some responses to a recent crime uptick, including two officer-involved cases in Buffalo, New York. In another officer-involved case out of Pennsylvania, a man with a criminal record allegedly tried to kill a police officer before authorities fatally shot him. Was it safe for him to be out on the streets? That's a question that also applies to another case we're going to look into this week, the murder of Deborah Humany 50 years ago in Michigan. Now, her convicted killer might go free, and Humany's sister explained why she's doing everything she can to prevent that from happening in an interview with Odyssey. Before we get to those stories, we have some quick crime roundups from coast to coast, including updates to the Matthew Perry death investigation in Los Angeles and another investigation into the death of a professional dancer in New York. We'll get started with a report from a horrific crime scene in the San Fernando Valley region of Los Angeles from Odyssey station KNX News.
In North Hills, four people, including a young boy and a baby, were found dead inside a home last night. All of them had been shot. Police, though, not looking for any suspects at this point. They believe it was a possible murder-suicide. Our John Baird's been at the scene all morning. It's not far from Parthenia and Woodley, and he joins us now live.
Yeah, nice middle-class neighborhood, neat neighborhood. Many people have lived here for years. They're just in shock that something like this would happen. We have been hearing that the woman involved, so it was a man and a woman in their late 30s with a young boy, maybe 4, 5, 6, something like that, and a 4-month-old baby. And what we're hearing is that the mom may have been the shooter. We have not been able to confirm that with police. We just know that people walking their dogs through the neighborhood are just in disbelief, and they just staring at the house wondering how this could happen.
You know, I was shocked. I was shocked because I couldn't believe that all this happened in my neighborhood. I mean, I don't know what went through that family to do that. It's really sad to think that somebody would take their life and their kids. I'm shocked. I don't know what to tell you, but I'm very sad for this.
And everyone is pretty much saying the same thing. They just do not believe something like that would take place here.
And we walk our dogs every day. Every single day we pass through here, and never have we seen anything weird out of this home. So
police are still investigating. They were here until about 5 o'clock this morning. So here all night long, they took down the yellow crime scene tape and have left. We're hoping to get more information from robbery homicide later in the day about what actually went down in that home last night. But a real tragedy here in North Hills.
KNX reported on another terrible crime linked to family this week in L.A.
The cops say she was taken by her father after he apparently killed her mother. Karen Adams is live at the home where it all started in L.A. Karen.
Alex, just an awful story. Next-door neighbor Israel Martinez is in disbelief. He says he knew the family. The little girl often played with his niece, and he heard nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. You gotta, say, why? How did it happen? I cannot understand.
An Amber Alert was issued after police discovered the mom of the 4-year-old girl, Deleza Fregosa, dead inside their home here on Alsace Avenue in West Adams. Now, the little girl gone, taken, police say, by her father, Ruben Fregoso. It prompted an Amber Alert yesterday. The man's white Land Rover was found miles away, Alex, in San Diego County. The father and daughter, though, are still missing. Now, some friends and family reportedly told reporters here earlier he might be headed for Mexico, where he has family. But it's still unclear where he is. Fregosa is 40, around 5'9", 200 pounds, with black hair, brown eyes. The little girl is about 3 feet tall, 45 pounds, with black hair and brown eyes. Now, there's no information, Alex, on what they were wearing when last seen, but if anyone has any information on their whereabouts, they're asked to call 911.
Yeah, really awful story. Karen Adams, hope they can find her.
And our final story from KNX this week is an update to the investigation into the 2023 death of Friends star Matthew Perry. Perry's former assistant was sentenced to jail time this week for his alleged role in the actor's overdose.
He is the one who was accused of injecting the ketamine that killed Perry. John Baird was in the courtroom for this, and he's live with us now. John.
That's right. Kenneth Iwamasa will serve 41 months. The defense had asked for just 6 months behind bars and 6 months of home confinement, but the judge gave him the top end of what the prosecutors had asked for. He had pleaded guilty and had prosecutors say it injected Matthew Perry with ketamine the day he was found dead in his hot tub. Reporters told Iwamasa's attorney that the defendant should have stopped it. He should have stepped in and done something. His response?
Right. He could have said no. Mr. Perry could have said no. Mr. Perry's handlers could have said no. Mr. Perry's family could have said no along the way. This is not an incident that falls solely on the shoulders of Mr. Iwamasa.
Again, he's saying that Mr. Perry had a role in his own death. But Keith Morrison, Matthew Perry's stepfather, said Iwamasa should have done the right thing and called somebody that day, or called somebody about Perry's use of drugs.
You call. You call his business manager, you call his publicist, you call his agent, you call me, you call his mother, you call his stepmother, you call his father.
He basically said, you didn't check on him, you killed him. The defendant will be back here in July, July 17th, that's the day he is to surrender to start serving time in federal prison.
O'Shea Sibley was a dancer who had moved from Philadelphia to New York. His life was cut short while he was dancing at a gas station in Brooklyn. Odyssey station 1010 Winds in New York reported on his alleged killer this week.
The man accused of killing a professional dancer at a Brooklyn gas station 3 years ago is on the witness stand today. Dmitry Popov, who was 17 at the time, allegedly stabbed O'Shea Sibley, who was 28. Sibley was dancing with friends while pumping gas at the station in Midwood. Police say Sibley and his friends had just come from the beach and they stopped at a filling station to get gas. Everybody's being crazy, having fun. Well, they all got into a heated debate with Popov, who allegedly made homophobic and racist comments towards them. And then things turned physical. Sibley got knifed in the chest. He died. Popov is charged with murder as a hate crime now. Sibley was a well-known dancer featured in music videos and had performed in music videos and at Lincoln Center. Beyonce posted about his death on her website. So did Spike Lee. He's a pretty popular guy.
1010 Winds also reported on this frightening case in the Bronx on Wednesday.
A 23-year-old woman is dead after being shot last night near a park in the Bronx.
23-year-old Raina Caceres gunned down. The killing happening right in front of a park in near PS 91 here on Aqueduct Avenue. Now, this young man stopped to talk with me. He lives on the block watching the police investigation all morning.
It's been calm. It's not too crazy, but every now and then it just pops off.
But when you see something like this, I mean, she got shot in the eye. I mean,
to be a woman that got shot is crazy.
Yeah. The witnesses are saying Caceres was in the middle of a group partying on the street when the violence broke out. Bottles, a boombox, even a hookah bong left behind, strewn amidst the sidewalk inside the police tape. Glenn Schuck, 1010 Winds, 92.3 FM, here in University Heights in the Bronx.
Winds also covered the developing supermarket slasher case this week.
At this hour, police are still searching for the person who went on a slashing spree this morning before sunrise at a grocery store in Sunset Park. And in the end, one man lay dead, another is hospitalized, nursing a terrible gash on his face. 1010 Wins reporter Amanda Alexander on that investigation.
Police on the lookout for the person responsible for stabbing two people, one in the face, the other the torso. It all happened around 5 Thursday morning in front of City Fresh Market. It's a 24-hour grocery store. That's when police say some sort of a dispute happened before both men were jabbed. They were taken to NYU Langone Hospital. One died, the other stable. This investigation ongoing. Amanda Alexander, 1010 Wins on 92.3 FM. In Brooklyn.
And police continue to talk with people there, and they're looking for video as well to try to figure out who the slasher is. Still no word on what led to the fight, which led to that death.
Within weeks of a mass shooting at a San Diego mosque, Odyssey station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities covered a shooting that occurred this Wednesday during a Muslim prayer service.
Police say they were called to a weapons complaint at the Canterbury Park Expo Center, where a prayer service for Eid al-Adha, a Muslim holiday, was taking place. When they arrived, they found a 26-year-old man with multiple gunshot wounds. Police have not said if the shots were fired inside the expo. The man was taken to Hennepin Healthcare, but his condition is not known at this time. They say they're actively working to identify the individuals involved, but no arrests have been made. Taylor Rivera, News Talk 830, WCCO.
Shakopee police say they were called to the scene about 10 o'clock this morning and found a 26-year-old man who'd been shot multiple times. They say that man was taken to Hennepin County Medical Center for treatment but has since died. The Samaha Islamic Center was hosting an Eid al-Adha prayer service at the center. No word yet on what led up to the shooting, and police say they have not yet made any arrests.
Police later identified the victim as Khalid Ibrahim Abdi, who was expecting his first child, according to a local Fox station. Authorities have identified the suspect in the murder as 28-year-old Mohammed Abdirazak Raj. In Philadelphia, Odyssey station KYW News Radio reported on a bizarre case involving a suitcase.
A 53-year-old woman faces murder charges in the shooting death of a man whose decomposing remains were found last week inside a suitcase in the city's Kensington neighborhood. As crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson tells us, three others also face charges in connection with this case.
53-year-old Vincent Good was being taken care of by his girlfriend, 53-year-old Liza Ridley. They both lived in an apartment on Leonard Street near Cheltenham Avenue in the city's Wissanoming neighborhood, says Deputy Commissioner Frank Van Orr.
He was an amputee from an incident that occurred years before. He had an injury with a trolley.
Good's dismembered body was found in a Kensington alley last week inside a suitcase and some trash bags. It was badly decomposed. Prosecutor Sidney Pope says Ridley confessed to killing Good a few weeks ago and disposing of his body.
She ultimately admitted to shooting the decedent in the head.
Officials say a rideshare driver also called investigators about taking a woman with a terrible smelling suitcase across town to the area where the body was found. And that driver took pictures, which is now evidence in the case. Three others, including Liza's sister, 55-year-old Bernadette Ridley, and daughter, 32-year-old Liza Robinson, and her boyfriend, 31-year-old Janaeus Daniels, face lesser charges, including conspiracy, abuse of corpse, and tampering with evidence. Authorities are still looking into a motive, but believe it may have been financial in nature. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
Another case involving intimate partner crime comes out of Odyssey station WWJ News Radio in Detroit. Back in 1976, Leslie Moran was convicted in the murder of his wife, 22-year-old Deborah Humany Moran. Now he's 85 years old, and he's been granted parole. Humany's sister, Sandra Humany, is appealing the decision, and her petition has been backed up by the Oakland County Prosecutor and the Attorney General's office. She spoke with WWJ's Darilyn Horn about the case this week.
It's very, very sad. My sister was 22 years old at the time of her execution-style premeditated murder, although there wasn't a conviction of first degree, it was second degree. I was 15 at the time. It's just such a mischaracter of justice, given what's gone on and the continued lies that he's been telling. And the same, I guess my issue is, In 50 years, he is the same man who pulled the trigger premeditatedly as he is today from a mental standpoint. He has no remorse. He continues to victim blame. He lies under oath about even purchasing the guns that day that he killed her. He engaged in no rehabilitation. And the problem is, the reasons that he was denied parole in 2017 and 2022 were evident again in 2026. Although there's been the passage of time, he is the same person. He is the same danger to society. My sister doesn't have a voice. My widowed mother, who lost her daughter, always prayed that justice would prevail. It hasn't. And this is, it's very sad. And I need to be my mother's voice, and I need to be my sister's voice.
So when you say he's not remorseful, what do you mean by that?
In his 2017 hearing, he was asked under oath by the parole board member what was his greatest regret in life. He said being raised a Baptist. He continues to blame my sister, and he creates lies about her character and her actions to justify, in his mind's eye, her death. He has appealed 17 times. He has requested a commutation over the last 50 years from six different governors who've all said no. He blamed his psychologist. He blamed people that he told that he was going to murder my sister for the murder because they didn't report him. Nothing is his problem. Everything that happens is somebody else's problem. He cannot accept responsibility. He's never apologized. He doesn't use my sister's name. He will talk in the third person. He will not answer questions directly. Simple yes or no. And all of this, all of his lies and his ability to manipulate, dominate, and control, they're all demonstrable throughout, from the 50 years through his hearings. He has never said he's sorry. He tries to explain away why he did what he did.
So to hear that this could be a parole stay, under the impression, when I looked it up, that means like he's considered to be on parole, just considered.
Well, the parole board granted him parole on April 14th. As the victim, I have a right to appeal. So on behalf of my sister, my family, I have joined the Oakland County prosecutor and the state attorney general's office, who are also appealing the conviction. I'm sorry, appealing the parole.
Gotcha.
So there is an application for parole in front of Judge Cunningham currently. He will review that application and decide whether or not the application has merit to move forward for him to hear the appeal and then rule on the appeal.
Okay. So it's not necessarily set in stone just yet, but the fact that it's being considered is the issue.
Well, he was granted parole, and the stay temporarily blocks the MDOC from releasing him until there is a ruling on this application for appeal and hopefully ultimately the appeal itself.
So it must feel good to have the support of the Michigan Attorney General as well as the prosecutor's office, right?
Yes, and they have been uniformly behind the denial of parole from the first time that he was eligible for parole in 2007. There have been changes in the Attorney General's office, in the Oakland County Prosecutor's office, everybody has been behind the denial of parole. The successor judge, Judge Langford Morris at the time, was in support of the denial of parole. Judge Alice Gilbert, the original trial judge, sentenced him to life. That was under second degree, but he could have been sentenced to a term. She, in her later years off the bench, in fact, wrote a letter expressing her concern if he were to be paroled, and expressed that when she sentenced him to life, she meant life, his natural life in prison.
Mm-hmm. So if he is granted parole, what does that mean for you and your family? I read statements about you guys not feeling safe, and, you know, what does that mean for you guys if he is granted parole?
It's terrifying. He might be 50 years older, but he has the same mind. And in fact, in his 2017 hearing, when he lied about purchasing the gun that he killed my sister with the day that he murdered her, even though there was the receipts for the guns were in his pocket when he was arrested, his own trial testimony, he stated he bought the two guns that day. The gun clerk testified that he bought the guns that day. He said he didn't because he wants to blunt this premeditatedness of it. I then testified at the 2017 hearing after he did, saying, no, read the transcript, read his words, look at the receipts. He bought the guns that day. After he was denied parole, he accused me of perjury and appealed to the parole board, Oakland County, Michigan Court of Appeals, and the Michigan Supreme Court, stating that he was denied parole based on my perjured testimony, that I lied about his purchase of the guns. He will come get me. He has a pattern with especially women. You, in his mind's eye, you don't disrespect him. You don't go against him. He controls, manipulates, dominates, and gets what he wants. And when he doesn't, this is what happened with my sister. He will come after me.
Wow, that's very eerie. Excuse me. Wow. Yeah. And you truly, truly believe that?
Yes.
Wow.
He doesn't, because he has the same pattern of thought and speech that he did in 1977. I read his trial transcript, all 11. I was there as a 15-year-old in the courtroom. I am the only one, really, who knew him then and who knows him today. He doesn't like that.
Well,
he's a very scary, very scary person.
I can definitely understand your trauma just based on what you knew then versus now. There's still a lot more steps to go.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. It's, I saw the pictures, the color glossies of the murder scene. My sister had come home and was living with my widowed mother, and our father died. I have an older brother who's 10 years older. My father died in 1964 and left my mother to raise the three of us. My sister came home and lived with us during her estrangement. The day that she was murdered was my aunt's birthday. She wore a sweater of mine that day. And I'll never forget seeing those photographs of her on the floor with six bullets in her, in my sweater. You can't erase that.
Wow.
And this is a smart guy. I mean, he's got his master's. He was working on his PhD. He was a college professor. So he doesn't lack the intellect. he has a sick mind. He can't acknowledge responsibility. He speaks in circles. He will turn and twist answers. And he always searches for the answer that he thinks whomever's asking him wants the answer. He won't acknowledge anything. He will talk in the third person. No one has the right to take a life. He'd say something like that.
Is it anything else you want to add?
I fear not only for my own safety, but for the safety of the community and my family. Again, I couldn't save my sister, but I owe it to her, her memory, and my mother to keep her alive, to keep her voice heard, to keep justice being served, and to help somebody not become another victim of his.
In the town of Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, police killed an armed 38-year-old man named Jonathan Simmons this week. Simmons had a criminal record, but while he was armed, reports indicate that he didn't fire his gun and that no officers were injured in the incident. Here's some more information on the case from Marty Griffin out of Odyssey Station KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I'm sitting here. I've been thinking about this since last night when a bunch of people sent me that insanely dramatic video of that Wilkinsburg man with two guns trying to kill a cop. I always trying to figure out why. Why did he do that? I'm sitting here looking at his picture. Looks like a kid. He's 38. This is what's kind of weird to me. Now, in case you haven't heard this, I started getting texts that this guy wanted to kill a cop. He had two guns. He went running at cops. He had every intention of killing a cop last night. I listened to this clip by county police, and then I'll get into some of his background and what the hell might have gone on here. Listen.
The officer, while patrolling, encountered this male who was armed with a handgun. He was displaying the gun to the officer. He was saying a lot of things, taunting the officer. The officer exited the vehicle. This is all according to witnesses that were in the area. The male displayed the firearm, displayed the handgun. The officer gave him numerous verbal commands to drop the firearm. The male did not drop the gun. The officer engaged, fired at the male, and the male went down.
If you watched the video, it's hard to watch. I posted it on X. It's incredibly dramatic. It's the acting chief in Wilkinsburg as he maneuvers around his car trying to get shot to death. And then he opens the car door trying to grab his rifle. And then this suspect is shot and later dies. And there's a couple theories here, and I'm going to throw them at you. Let me throw this at you, though. If you think this guy's a hardened criminal that should be in jail right now, I kind of raise this issue. He has not been in jail, confined in jail, since 2014. Now, that tells me one of two things. Either A, he got his act together, or B, he didn't, but just didn't get caught. But he's dead this morning. And we're lucky, quite frankly, that a cop isn't dead. I mean, it was that bad. If you watch the video, it's insane. And he was begging them. He wanted to shoot a cop. And he didn't listen to one command. Now there's two theories here. Number one. And let me get through his prior arrest first, in case you're trying to figure out his background. Firearms charges, terroristic threats charges, receiving stolen property charges. He's no saint. Robbery with intention of inflicting serious bodily injury. Robbery of a motor vehicle. More firearms charges. More terroristic threats charges. Assault charges. Recklessly endangering another person charges. He has several pages of charges. I'm not suggesting he's a saint. But what I'm suggesting is the young man hasn't been in jail since 2014. That's a big, big, big gap from what we can find. And if you see his picture, he has this baby face. And there's one of two things that are being floated this morning as to what could have happened. Number one, that he was high as a kite, kind of out of his mind high, kind of delusional high, and didn't know what the hell he was doing, and had these two illegal firearms, which is a whole nother issue that plagues America, right? In many of these communities, like Wilkinsburg. And with all, for all intents and purposes, he wanted to kill that police officer, the acting chief in Wilkinsburg. And thank goodness he was not hurt. If you watch the video, it's amazing he wasn't shot. The other thing that's being floated out there, and I've kind of closely watched this my entire career. It's called suicide by cop. And what happens is, these are folks, I'm just trying to be real with you, these are folks that want to die in a blaze of glory every year. And it's an incident where they intentionally engage cops. Look, I've seen them run out of their house with a screwdriver pointed, a butter knife pointed, and cops don't know that. They think it's a gun. Suicide by cop. Describe an incident in which a suicidal individual intentionally engages in life-threatening and criminal behavior with a lethal weapon or what appears to be a lethal weapon to provoke officers to shoot the suicidal individual in self-defense. Mm-mm-mm. They found several hundred of these cases a year. 150 to 200 cases of suicide by cop a year. I don't know what happened here. We haven't talked to someone who knows this young man, Jonathan Simmons, 38 years old, of Wilkinsburg. But there's several issues that concern me and should concern you. Number one, illegal firearms. Number two, the out of control, I want to kill a cop attitude that was heard at the scene by cops just trying to take cover and defend themselves. And number three, that he may have wanted cops to take him out. And what concerns me is several issues. The firearms, the drug issue, the danger issue that cops face on the streets every single day. And they never know who the hell wants to kill them. It's sad that this young man's dead. It's awful that he's dead. Awful. And maybe somehow at some point we'll try to understand, but he has not been in jail since 2014. Which makes me wonder why. Why he wanted to die last night. And thank goodness for the actions of police officers involved that saved that cop's life, the acting chief of Wilkinsburg. Jonathan Simmons is dead. We may never know why. We know how. We know that circumstance. This is the threat that cops face on the streets every single day of their lives. Awful.
Officer-involved incidents have also made headlines recently in Buffalo, New York. On the same day that Simmons was shot, a Buffalo police officer was shot multiple times while responding to a call on the city's east side. That shooting came just days after another officer was stabbed during an officer-involved shooting. Here's Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk with the report.
A Buffalo police officer shot multiple times while responding to a call on the city's east side yesterday afternoon. WBEN's Brayton Wilson has the details.
Just a few days following an officer-involved shooting in Buffalo's East Side neighborhood along Broadway, another shooting involving city police officers took place at a residence just a few blocks away on Sherman Street.
Around 2:15 this afternoon, officers were dispatched to 256 Sherman Avenue. The call came in as a female asking for help, that her husband had locked her in a room, taken her phone, had a pistol, and had threatened to sodomize her.
That's Buffalo Police Commissioner Erica Shields. When officers arrived at the residence, they gained entry into the house with the help of a family member of the suspect wanting to get help for their loved one. After trying to arrest the suspect, getting one handcuff on him in the kitchen, the suspect then pulled out a concealed weapon on him and fired shots that struck one officer multiple times in the legs as well as the shoulder and the arm area. Officers then returned fire and struck the suspect multiple times as well. Both men were transported to ECMC to be treated for their injuries following an incident that all unfolded within a time span of about a minute. Shields was able to briefly see the veteran officer of 9 years on the force after the shooting.
He was in a great deal of discomfort. He's got surgery before him, but he was alert and speaking. So we're very grateful for that. Everybody just said he is the nicest guy and has nothing bad to say about anyone, is constantly upbeat. So there was a lot of emotion around him as an individual.
Shields adds officials were in the process Tuesday evening of securing warrants to search the house, as it was rumored that there were other guns the suspect may have owned. Brayton Wilson, WBEN. News.
Brayton, thank you. This is one of several recent violent incidents on the East Side. In just the past few weeks, there was a shooting in which a person was shot in the neck and legs on Monday. Saturday, there was a man shot multiple times on Walden Avenue. A Buffalo police officer was stabbed by a suspect on Broadway near Liddell. Commissioner Shields was asked about this spike in violence.
They appear random. There seems to be a lot of one-offs, as opposed to a connection or gang activity. But certainly we are sitting down and developing summer plans to address this, you know, what is becoming problematic very early in the summer season.
Buffalo Police Benevolent Association President John Davidson joined WBEN to discuss the recent incidents.
First, John, do you have any update for us? How is the officer doing?
So first I can say that the officer is stable, and we'd love to continue with all the prayers we're receiving, all the goodwill we're receiving. We want to pray for this officer and his family. We want to pray for the medical staff at ECMC to continue the care that they're giving. And just thank you from the citizens and the people that have reached out to the PBA and to this member for his heroic actions.
Yeah, a lot of people reaching out. I mean, this does go to show how dangerous the job can be. You'd have to imagine that, you know, a lot of people, when they hear this, so when this happened, you know, it's an afternoon call, maybe a routine check-in, and then all of a sudden the worst thing imaginable happens out of this.
Certainly. So, yes, I was on my way from a funeral for John Evans, who passed away 11 months into retirement. So going from that event where a gentleman like him did so much for so many people, reflecting on that, I'm on my way to headquarters for a debriefing on an officer that was stabbed just earlier this week. While I'm on my way to that, I am rerouted to ECMC for an officer that sustained gunfire. Both of these incidents happened in the middle of the day in the city of Buffalo.
What is going on? It just seems in the last couple of weeks, a spike in violence has really risen around the city. What are you seeing?
Sure. I think there's a few prongs to this. I think you're running into the fact that crime tends to go up, not just in Buffalo, but in most cities, especially cold weather cities. Crime does tend to spike in the summer months. We're finally, after a very long winter, experiencing some heat. I also don't think it's any secret that we are severely understaffed. The mayor's office new budget calls for 814 officers. We are currently 100 below that. Also, I think 814 might also be a little low. So we're short anywhere from 100 to 200 officers in the city of Buffalo. Everyone has been talking about how crime has been historic lows for the last 2 years. The PBA has been warning that that rubber band will snap at some point. You've got more officers retiring than you can recruit. Last year, we had double the number of retirees that we've had in any year in the previous five. This year, to combat 47 retirees, we've only hired five, and one of them has already left, said this wasn't for them. So we're trying to replace 47 officers with four. In addition to that, we've had almost double-digit retirements already this year. I don't think it's shocking to know that that's probably driven by a lot of factors. One, I would say the biggest would be that we've been out of contract for 331 days. And without a contract, it's difficult to maintain the staffing you have, retain the officers that are working, and it's also hard to recruit officers. I don't think it's any secret that throughout the entire state, departments are having trouble bringing in new officers. The departments that are having success are giving it the more benefits or more fringe benefits or higher pay or something to draw in new recruits. We've been out of contract for 331 days. I think now is a great time to sit down with the city and come up with some way to continue to keep the officers we have and to recruit future officers.
Well, it's, I mean, kind of a situation here where you have all these events going on at one time, and I'm wondering how the police department reacts. What's your conversation been like with the police commissioner about how she is looking to react? Because she's brand new to the job and now dealing with this in the first couple of weeks. How is she reacting to this spate of crime on the east side?
Well, I will say that it's baptism by fire, right? She's not new to policing. She's been a police officer for decades in cities that also have high violent levels. So I wouldn't say she's overwhelmed by this by any means. She seems to be willing to work with the PBA. She seems to be willing to learn from those around her. I think former interim commissioner, current deputy commissioner Macy has been an incredible resource. I think they're working together. I know with yesterday's incident, it was reassuring to hear that immediately when this happened, the deputy commissioner Macy went to the scene, immediately shut down streets so that the ambulance could get to ECMC impeded and in the quickest possible fashion. I think at the same time, the commissioner immediately went to the hospital to begin working with me and the members to make sure that this is a seamless event. I don't think we're at a point these days in the city of Buffalo where labor and management have to bang their heads against each other. We're looking to work together. We want all boats to rise in a high tide. But I do think that the city of Buffalo needs to sit down and work out a contract to continue that.
Murray Holman was on with us earlier this morning, an East Side leader who said there is a proliferation of guns on the street, especially ghost guns. What are your officers seeing?
Yeah, we're seeing illegal guns all over the city of Buffalo. They're coming from all over. They're coming from basements where they're being made with 3D printers. They're coming from other states across state lines. They're coming from all over the place. They're being stolen and then used in crimes. This is a very dangerous time to be a police officer in the city of Buffalo. I think it's important to note that these officers, I can't speak a whole lot to yesterday's incident until the department wants to release certain information, but I can tell you regarding the stabbing where the officer was stabbed on Broadway earlier this week, that officer had complete and total coverage under Article 35 in the penal law of New York State to fire his weapon at that gentleman long before he started with de-escalation verbal techniques. They attempted taser. Then he went hands-on with a gentleman who had two edged weapons, and he did, of course, sustain a puncture wound because of that and slashing from a box cutter. And he then, with no other options, and long after he was totally authorized and justified, did have to fire upon that gentleman. He then immediately went to work saving that man's life by then kicking the knife out of his hand and administering first aid before he then went to the hospital to be treated for his stab wound. So I think it's important to note that our officers, the force use of force continuum states that you can use and you are authorized and you are advised to use one level higher than the force that you are being met with. And our officers routinely become superheroes, the kinds that you see in movies and comic books, where they decide, I'm going to go hands-on and try and save a life. These officers are committed to preventing the loss of life.
WBEN also spoke to Murray Holman with Stop the Violence Coalition and Peacemakers about how the community is working to quell violence.
Murray, there have been several recent incidents, two officer-involved shootings, stabbings, shootings. What are you noticing, and is this going to be a long, hot summer?
Yes, it's definitely going to be a long, hot summer, but the spike that, you know, usually takes place when warm weather hits Buffalo or Western New York, and we see most folks going out into the community, you know, trying to solve beefs, whatever that might be. And then, you know, our data has been down for the city of Buffalo and Western New York for violence, especially with gun violence. And now here it is, we get this spike, and it just makes the work a little bit harder for us in the community.
Yeah. What is it that changes? I mean, you see so many differences year to year in how kids are communicating, how things happen, but one thing remains constant. It's almost as soon as we get 70 degrees or something like that, we get a spat of violence. How come that remains constant throughout the years?
Well, you have most folks in our community that they're outside now. Most of your beefs from social media to young kids fighting gang violence, those spike up when they can catch you most vulnerable out, and you're supposed to be out trying to have a good time and be, you know, life worthy. And incidents that you might have had during the winter time comes back up, and here we are with, you know, flux of violence happening. But even with the two shootings with the police, Buffalo Police Department, you know, situations happen and things, you know, escalate to, you know, shots fired. You know, we have to question that. Our society has been, used to seeing things like this happening, not just in Western New York, but across America. You know, it's just the gun. I mean, not to take away Second Amendment rights for folks, you know, trying to protect yourself or their families. It's just, this gun issue is just so prevalent throughout our whole community.
Murray, talk to us about the availability of guns on the street. What do you know about it?
The availability of guns on the street, thanks to Governor Hochul and others in legislation, the availability of to purchase guns is more stricter. But then you have, you know, now the ghost gun is more popular in the community, and especially in urban communities. Ghost guns are made up and they're not traceable. We see a lot of those now. And then homes that's broken into in your, you know, your urban, in your rural neighborhoods, don't get reported, and these guns flow in. Then, especially being that we are borderline to Pennsylvania, to Ohio, guns come through here, and they sold on our streets for like less than $200-$300. And then now these guns are found up in, you know, as scenes of, you know, crimes being committed on our community.
There's always something different, as we talked about before. What's different with what you're doing, what other community groups are doing this year in terms of outreach and those things that we're so used to seeing from the peacekeepers and other groups?
Great. You know, thanks to, Mark Polenkars, our county exec, some years ago when COVID was prevalent in our community, he called us up, our organization, Stop the Violence Coalition, and said, what can he do? They came up with a program, the YEP program, that program is designed for young kids to stay out of trouble during high peaks of crime in the community from 4 o'clock to 9 o'clock. They're actually working in, like our group with Stop the Violence Coalition, call them colleagues. They're there to quote a beast, see what's going on. This program is designed to ask on application to ask, have you ever been involved in gun violence? Have you, you know, those type of questions are on application so they can get the help and the resources through the public, you know, concerns to make it work. That has been successful. It's going on for about 7 years, and it's great that that program is out there to quell beasts and violence. And then you have the E program with Back to Basics and other organizations. So we don't make any money. I don't make any money from it, but the kids, they get paid $16.50 an hour to be off our street. And you can look at that data and know it's successful. And we give them skills to teach them about, you know, going to college and, you know, being successful, not to pick up a gun, how to resolve their beefs. They actually have a radio show and a TV show that they do, and they talk to community leaders to see what, how can they help. And it's important that with our new mayor, that they meet with him and then give him their concerns and issues about what's on their mind. We're out of tune about this generation of young folks out here in our community about why are they fighting, why are they using guns. It's a different type of breed going on right now. It's not like before when we were doing like 90 to almost 80 homicides in the city of Buffalo. We're not having those numbers, but the kids are a little bit younger. We have the age of 12 and 13-year-olds using guns more. Before it was like 16, 17-year-olds using guns.
Buffalo isn't the only town where there have been concerns about teens and preteens committing crimes. For example, teen takeover incidents in Chicago have been making headlines. Here's political editor Jeff Buckles of Odyssey Station WBBM News Radio in Chicago covering last weekend's crime statistics, which might be a bit surprising.
The mayor told reporters here that the city's numbers confirmed no one was killed over the holiday weekend and shootings were down.
Communities across our city still felt the impact of an intolerable level of violence.
That includes Monday night's gathering at 57th Street Beach that moved into nearby Hyde Park. Officers arrested 53 people and seized 9 weapons.
We will not accept any act that places Chicagoans in danger.
And even though the mayor suggests most of the so-called teen takeovers in the city are shut down before they happen, last week's surge of activity has sparked new calls from city council for additional tools to punish parents whose children are involved.
There are already laws in the books that do that.
Should they be changed?
I mean, that's a legislative question.
He did not advocate for any specific change, nor would he comment on the concept of tougher punishment, saying it would be irresponsible to do so without seeing an actual proposal.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KNX News in Los Angeles, 1010 Winds in New York City, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, Marty Griffin of KDKA in Pittsburgh, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, and WBBM News Radio in Chicago. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.